Hello and welcome to Conker's Corner. And today I have the privilege of speaking with Phil Oakley. Now, Phil is a well-regarded and well-respected writer, analyst, author, blogger, presenter. I had the pleasure of being on stage with him at the masterclass at Derby for Mello earlier this year. And Phil and I got to talking about potentially doing and having a little chat in the future. And on that day also, Phil very kindly signed my book, which I'd taken with me, you know, because I'm a bit of a geek like that, How to Pick Quality Shares, which on the last time we spoke in the Conker's Corner, I said to Phil, I think you might have a book in you there. And subsequently it happened. So hello, Phil, and how are you today, mate?
I'm very well, thanks, Peter.
Now, a lot has happened since we last spoke and we recorded an interview, fella. And I know that at the last time we spoke, you were with the really, really good team at ShareScope. You'd written loads of articles for them. And, you know, the discussion we've had subsequently, more recently, is that, you know, you got an offer that was, you know, fitted in with your, you know, life balance and all the rest of it. So you made the move.
Yeah, I mean, I very much enjoyed my time working for ShareScope. And particularly working on the SharePad product, I just needed a bit of a change. The amount, the kind of work that I was doing there, I think, come to an end. And I've always preferred and enjoyed the writing side of my job. The other part of my job I had there was helping with the design of the software, which was great, but it had an end. An end point where I couldn't really do much more. And an opportunity came to work for the Investors Chronicle in quite an interesting role, actually. Not just doing my writing my articles, but also having quite a lot of input in terms of in-house training of young writing team there and various other things as well. So I think the change, the more of the focus on the stuff that I actually enjoy, and the timing was right. So so far so good.
Okay, so how long have you been at Investors Chronicle now, and what is it that you really got your teeth into? Because you've written quite a lot of articles in a very short space of time.
Yeah, I mean, I've been there about 10 weeks now.
Okay.
And really, I'm pretty much doing the same kind of writing as I was for SharePad. I have a column in the magazine every week, which alternates between, I mean, all of them have an educational focus, but they sort of swing between a topic of investment analysis, not just number crunching either. It's often looking for characteristics within business as well. So I'll do that 1 week, and then in the intervening week, I will do a company analysis, which tries to identify good and bad bits of a company.
Absolutely, and that sits well with the book, which I'm going to discuss with you in a sense of how to pick quality shares, Phil. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're in this era where, you know, lots of people are looking for quality companies, yeah?
Yeah.
And the difficulty is to get through the metrics to actually find the companies that you can remain invested in, because the markets are, as we all agree, are getting more volatile. Yeah. So you're a big fan of investing in quality companies, and you've written a book. The shares of these companies have performed very well in recent years. Do you think they are still attractive now, given the current market environment, Phil?
I have some very, very, very interesting question. These kind of companies are, you know, by their very nature, they are companies that do things that very few other companies can copy. So they are quite scarce. There are not many of them. And it's not terribly difficult to sort of identify them at a point in time. Where it is difficult is working out whether these companies will stay as good as they appear at the moment. Now, there has been a big repricing upwards of these kinds of companies probably over the last 7-8 years, pretty much since the current ongoing bull market, admittedly with a few hiccups in recent weeks, has been going on. The problem that investors are facing with these type of companies is twofold, really. One is the valuations, the price that investors are being asked to pay to own these kinds of companies now is pretty high. And just to explain what I mean by that is, you know, one of the most simple and effective ways to value a company is to look at it like an interest rate or a yield and compare it with a savings account or, more commonly, the interest rate you get on government bonds. Now, the interest rate on shares, I tend to look at something called the free cash flow yield. A lot of the yields on these companies are quite low, certainly less than 5%, some 4-3%, or some even lower. And in America, the interest rate on government bonds has been going up and is now 3 and a bit percent. Now, when interest rates were 1 and a bit percent, then it was a relatively easy decision for people to own high quality and higher yielding assets. That decision now is becoming more blurred and more difficult because not only are the interest rates on bonds, particularly in America, rising, we have this whole issue now of whether these so-called quality companies can keep on growing, to therefore grow the return over time to the owners, to the shareholders. And that's the kind of standoff and situation that we have in the stock market for a lot of companies at the moment. And because of that, I think we're in a very difficult position. I'd like to give a clear answer and say, hey, you know, over the long term, these are still going to be really good investments. And I think some of them will be, but I think it's a lot harder now. I think that we've been moved along on a tide of momentum, upwards momentum. And for a while, a lot of people didn't worry. And now we've had events such as rising interest rates, the trade situation between America and China particularly, and people are now beginning to start to focus on points that actually have been quite obvious to lots of people for a long time.
You made several good points there, Phil. I mean, I think I want to touch on a couple, if I may. Firstly, the trade war, the unspoken war that what's going on between America and China, in a sense of impacting not only the tech stocks but all stocks, oil, you know, and anything that's being consumed and shared, and commodities, etc., between the two. And also the you touched on the momentum stocks, in the sense of we're going to touch on some of the stocks later on, but there are some significant stocks along in the FTSE All Share, FANG stocks, some quite significant size stocks in the on the AIM exchange, which on the PE ratio, they're scary, you know, and lots of people on a herd-like mentality across Twitter are all gone into these stocks. And during August, they had a bit of a blip. And then again, in October, some of them just rolled right over, dropping 10, 20, 30%. And a lot of people just did not know what to do.
So yeah.
What advice would you give these, the momentum traders, in the sense of being sensible and when to buy these stocks and when to actually look, this has had a good run, maybe take some off the table and look to see what happens going forward?
I think the thing about momentum is that there are lots of studies to say that it actually is quite a good investing strategy.
Agreed, yeah.
The problem with it is that it works until it doesn't. And that sounds, you know, a bit of a sort of silly comment in isolation, but what I mean by this is that it requires a lot of people to keep on thinking the same thing, in that the shares will keep on going up, and it requires the company concerned to keep on doing things better than people expect by making more money, or telling investors that they're going to make more money than they expect. But at the end of the day, valuation always, always comes back. It might take a long time, but eventually there will be a sanity check in terms of the valuation that you are being asked to pay for any particular share. And the higher that valuation is, roughly speaking, means that the more growth is factored into the share price. And once you get doubts that that growth is going to come through, you lose the marginal buyer of that share to keep the share price going up. And everybody, or lots of people, start scurrying for the exit, and you get the process working in reverse. So you can make, there are people out there who are very, very good at exploiting momentum. And there are other people who perhaps jump onto this bandwagon thinking that they can make the money, and they find that perhaps they've got in at the wrong time and they can't get out, particularly in very illiquid small cap shares. Once the tide turns on these types of companies, you can be in a very, very sticky situation. And I think that's what we've seen in the last few weeks, that momentum, yes, the returns are there, but if you're buying into that strategy, for a lot of the time, you also have to accept, and this is where I think people get it wrong, is that you're taking on considerable risk as part and parcel of that strategy. And that risk obviously gets reflected when you get a reversal.
Yeah, with the increased volatility. Now, my concern regarding the momentum, and I agree with you that it works until it doesn't, is the fact that it would appear to me, and it does with a few other fund managers I've spoken to of late, that those that deem themselves to be investors have become momentum traders, not momentum investors. So that in and out of these stocks, willy-nilly, and the churn factor is absolutely amazing, in the sense of, they bought this stock, they're saying they're going to hold it for you know, long term, and then 3 weeks, 3 months, 3 days later, they've sold the stock.
Totally agree. People won't like being told that, but they've ceased to become investors, and they've pretty much become speculators or traders. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing wrong with that, actually. I mean, some people actually say that's a bit of a dirty word and an insult, and I don't mean it that way. I think if you accept that that is what you are trying to do, then that is absolutely fine.
Agreed. Yeah.
If you are saying that you're a long-term investor and you're selling out of shares after a very short period of time because the price trend has temporarily or permanently gone against you, then perhaps you need to rethink what you're trying to achieve. But I do think we've got ourselves, in certain sections of the stock market, into a situation where valuation didn't matter or didn't appear to matter. And if it was a good business with growth, then you could almost pay any price for that. And that's worked in the short term. I think now we are getting a sense of reckoning on a lot of these companies, particularly the FANGs, as you mentioned earlier on, and also I think on some of these AIM stocks that have done so well. But there's been a disconnect between the fundamentals of the business, undoubtedly some of those are very attractive, and the price that you're actually being asked to pay. And I think one of the things that I have learned, I think, over my career, one of the biggest weaknesses that I had when I was starting out as an investor, I was obsessed with valuation, and I ignored the quality of the business and the growth prospects of the business. Now I am much more the other way. I'm much more focused on the quality of the underlying business and the growth, and I accept that you have to pay up. You can't expect to get these businesses for cheap prices, but there's a limit to that. There's a limit to, you know, what becomes sensible and what becomes slightly silly and actually dangerous to your financial well-being. And I think that some of these shares have crossed that line.
There are so many great books and individuals that are spoken about, but you have to pay the price for quality. And when you end up buying something that's inferior, you know, you're going to be unable to hold it for the long term, whether it be because the moats don't exist, the return on equity don't exist long term, or, you know, in a lot of instances, you've got where, I'm going to touch on a little bit later on, you've got where the accounts don't appear to exist, you know, so you've got to do your research. And sometimes it's better to pay up for quality, like you say, to have the right valuations that you can be around with them for a long time.
Definitely. And I think it applies to a lot of things in life, actually. You know, if you pay up for something that's slightly, you know, better built, made with very good materials, it's going to actually look after you better than something that's put together very cheaply with bad materials. And the same sort of theory and logic applies to investing in businesses.
Agreed. Now, Phil, one of the key themes of your book, How to Pick Quality Shares, is keeping investors away from some of these. I think we touched on it in Mellow Derby about red flags. You know, keeping investors away from bad companies. What are the lessons that investors can take away from the current ongoings at Patisserie Valière? Cake is the ticker symbol. Could investors have spotted the trouble before it was hit? Were there some telltale signs, do you think?
I think just touch on the first point that you mentioned about bad companies and bad investments. And this is probably the most important part of the investing process, is staying away from bad companies. Bad companies can absolutely destroy an investor's portfolio. And big falls in share prices, in the worst case, you get wiped out completely. But if you get a big fall from your buying price, you need a big increase just to get back to where you were. And therefore, if you look at some of the most successful investors out there, and this again reinforces the buying good businesses approach, is that they avoid bad companies and the mistakes and the damage that those mistakes make to the actual performance of their investments over time. It's very, very, very hard to recover from that kind of damage. And you should do your utmost to stay away from those kind of businesses. And there are a lot of those businesses on the stock exchange. They look attractive because they have low valuations, but quite often you end up getting suckered into to what's known as a value trap, and you can end up in a terrible mess. And there are lots and lots of examples of that. On to Patisserie Holdings. I think it was very, very difficult for any outsider looking at this company, looking at the numbers in the accounts, to spot what went on, which looks pretty much like a case of straight fraud. That said, obviously hindsight is a wonderful thing, and I'm sure what comes out of the investigation into this company is going to have a lot of lessons for us all, hopefully. But I always thought there were a couple of sort of points that you think back, and the first one, I mean, and I've put this in writing as well, so I'm not using hindsight, I was always slightly suspicious of this company in that it never disclosed the like-for-like sales from its existing shops, which most retailers do. And when you're looking at a retailing business, one of the things you want to look at is how the existing business is doing. Is the existing business still growing, or is this business just growing because it's adding more money in the form of more shops?
So let me interrupt you there. For the layman, then, you're talking about the organic growth, yeah?
Yeah, so you know, you open up a shop and it builds up over time, it builds up to its sort of potential level of sales and profitability. And then you want to see, once it's in steady state, whether it's a standalone shop that can keep on getting more customers, selling more stuff, and just slowly growing or even quickly growing. But you want to see what the underlying business is doing, because if you can't see what the underlying business is, then you think you might be buying into a growth company when actually you're not. Because what actually has happened is all that a company is doing is, it's like when you put money in a savings account and you get an interest on it. Now, you can grow the money by getting a higher rate of interest on your existing savings, or you can grow by putting more money into the savings account. And retail businesses that grow by adding more shops are pretty much can be quite similar as to putting more money into a savings account. And that, whilst that is growth, and it can be reasonable growth if those assets and new shops are earning decent returns on investment, it's not the highest quality growth out there. And I always thought it was a little bit strange that Patisserie never told investors what was going on in its existing shops. Now, whether that, and I think that would have, you know, raised some concerns, because the problem with businesses like this is that you get the illusion of growth sometimes just through a maturation of a shop. So a shop opens and it might take a year or year and a half, 2 years to build up to what its actual potential level of sales will be. Now, in the first year, that's not included in the underlying sales growth, but in the second year, it is. And you can get this illusion of growth, but actually, what's happening is it's just a maturing store base. But we never had any idea whatsoever, really, what was going on in the underlying business. And that's something that I said a couple of years ago or a year ago, and I've put that in print rather than actually with the wisdom or the benefit of hindsight. Everything else, if you look at, you know, the cash generation, it looked reasonably good for a business that was expanding. I've heard a point made to me recently, which is actually a very simple one, and I actually think a very, very good one, which was, no, very few people, and I'm sure, and hats off to those that did, just took a step back from this business and said, "This is a very profitable business. What does it do? It sells cakes and sandwiches and nice things. Can a business like this really be as profitable as this? Does this seem too good to be true?" Now, of course, we now know that it was too good to be true. But yeah, as I say, it's very, very easy to be wise with hindsight, but I think it was very difficult for someone to spot this going wrong.
Well, as I, you said you put it in print, but you also touched on a similar sort of issue that was going on a little while back. And in your book, in the small part of another chapter, you put the importance of growth, and you touched on Restaurant Group in the early 2016, and how they were growing rapidly, but that seemed to start to decline and slow down. So that was another example where you've got the growth has got to be sustainable, and we've seen what's happened to the share price since then, having peaked around £7 and come down, and now they're having to go out and make a purchase of Wagamama to, you know, to keep their growth going.
Yeah, I think that's a really bad deal. I think I have a few, you know, a few regrets about the book, and I think one of the things I could have done better was have spent a bit more time discussing this growth angle, because it is incredibly important. You can get a lot of companies that stack up very well on profits, cash flow, low debts, good business, but if they can't grow, it's very difficult for an investor to actually make money and compound the value of their investment over time. And there are, as I've touched on a few minutes ago, there are different types of growth, and therefore the quality of growth, of which organic underlying sales growth is the best is something that investors should pay a lot of attention to.
Agreed.
You know, you have to look at the ability of this company to sell more stuff or sell more of a service rather than throw more money at it, buy companies, cut costs. So you have to start with the top line, the revenue line, and focus on how that company is growing. And hopefully the better companies out there will need to spend less money to drive that top line growth than other companies will. But as I said a couple of minutes ago, if they can't do that, then being able to invest money at a high rate of return is the next best thing.
Agreed. The issue for me, Phil, looking at it overall, is that it just appears to me that the only retailers that are actually making money and doing well and being consistent over the what has been a very difficult 3 to 5 years for retailers has been the ones that were proactive, you know, 5-10 years previously and having gone online very, very early on. And the more recent ones that are going, very reluctantly shutting down a lot of their bricks and mortar stores, going online, they've left it almost too late to make the margins up. And the margins are very, very thin in comparison to those that are predominantly now online.
I think that's absolutely correct. You just have to look at companies like ASOS, Boohoo. These companies, they're not burdened by the legacies of high street stores and rents. They've invested in modern, up-to-date, efficient supply chains. And these companies have huge advantage over laggards such as, Marks and Spencer's, their results were on Wednesday this week. I mean, that company has essentially just been very negligent in terms of adapting to the changing retail environment. The problem with retail, I think, from an investor's point of view, is that if you look at the history of this sector, it's almost better to travel than arrive. They are pretty much trading stocks, as from what I can see, in that you make the most money from them when they are sort of at the beginning or in the sort of middle of their growth phase, because it seems to me that very few retailers have the ability to stand the test of time, and once they get to a mature state, they don't seem to be able to keep on growing. In fact, they have to run very, very hard to stand still. And it's what's known as, in terms of the investment and the life cycle of a company, it's known as the sort of riding the rollout on a physical retailer, on an internet retailer. What eventually tends to happen, from what I can see, is that you get big, strong phase of growth, and eventually you then have to spend money to either keep growing, to cope with the amount of demand that you've created. So the returns can look really good, but eventually you have to spend money in the forms of more logistics, more warehousing, to keep that growth going. Now, that can still work quite well, but I think with the internet has done something in pretty much every business that we can think of. And in some ways, it's done two things that have been good and bad. As far as the investor's concerned, or the consumer's concerned, it's empowered consumers. It's given them a lot more transparency on what they're paying for stuff. From business point of view, because the requirement to invest huge amounts of money, keeping retail here, they don't have to invest huge amounts in bricks and mortar. The barriers to entry into this market have come down. And therefore, you can get a lot of competition, which eventually competes down the returns that these companies can make. And it's no surprise that a lot of the companies that are growing in this world, in retail, I think of ASOS, Amazon is a great example. They they do it on very, very thin profit margins, and they have to sell lots of stuff. And those that can't have a business model that does that, sorry, they can't prosper.
Absolutely agree.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sorry. I was going to say we touched on the bricks and mortar thing, and one of the main areas, or one of the areas that you've written a lot about, obviously, Phil, is the house builders who have also been in the news of late, and we also had the budget. So I've got another question I wanted to touch on in this conversation about house builders and your thoughts on them. So on lots of measures, house building companies looked and have looked like they meet the criteria for, we're talking about quality businesses here, high profit margins, return on capital employed, and you've been quite vocal in the past on the subject of Help to Buy, and you did a big presentation on it at Mello again earlier this year. What are your views now on those companies, given the recent, I would say, almost debacle on certain aspects regarding wages and salaries and bonuses?
The short answer is that I think that things are probably as good as they're going to get now for house builders. They have been fantastic investments. And actually, if you look at it over the last 10 years, so taking into account even the financial crisis and the meltdown that we saw 2008, on a 10-year view, these companies have delivered absolute stellar returns to shareholders. They've been brilliant investments. And as you say, at this moment in time, they tick a lot of boxes in terms of high quality, and they look on traditional valuation methods incredibly cheap. And you think, well, what's going on here? And what's going on is that house builders, in my opinion, for the last 5 years, have not been operating in a true free market, primarily because the government has subsidized the mortgages of homes. It did it on all homes, actually, from April 2013 until December 16, Help to Buy, which, for those listeners who are not familiar with it, it's a 20% equity loan to buy a house outside London, 40% in London, which allows the buyer to put only a 5% deposit down, and also encourages, and this is the important bit, encourages banks to lend money against homes. Now, the problem we have with housing is that it is too expensive in this country, and we need to build more houses. But what Help to Buy has done is it's not addressed the issue of building more houses, really. It's just put money in people's pockets. Now, the builders have been chief beneficiaries of this because whilst the Help to Buy has been removed from existing homes, it still exists on new build homes and will continue to exist on new build homes until 2023. Now, what Help to Buy has done, and there is a lot of evidence supporting this now, is it has pushed up not only house prices in general, and you can see that by looking at any house price chart, but it has pushed up the price of new build homes relative to existing homes. And that is known in the trade as the new build premium. Now, that premium has been getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's something that I've been looking a lot locally, actually. And I think that the premium on a lot of these houses is 10, 15% above existing equivalent houses of the same type of size. And that premium has been going into the builders' pockets in the form of higher profits, which is why you've seen the builders paying big dividends, big returns of capital to their shareholders, and in certain instances, the chief executives of these companies walking away with massive bonuses. I think when I say it's as good as it can get now, what I mean by that is that the tide has essentially turned against the house builders. When Help to Buy came out, most builders probably had 4 or 5 years of land ahead of them to build out on, which they'd already agreed to either buy or had bought at a price. So the rising prices over the last 5 years have led to very big profits on the land that they built, the land that they bought previously. The problem they've got now is that prices have gone up so much, and the premium between new build and existing build is probably can't go much further. And you've got rising cost inflation in terms of wages, materials, which are putting pressure on margins. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult for them to meaningfully increase their profits. But it's not, whilst I'm saying it's as good as it can get, that doesn't mean it's going to be a disaster. As much as I dislike this scheme, it doesn't really matter what I think. So if I look at in terms of the cold hard facts for the builders, if this scheme supports prices at their current level and they can build similar amounts or slightly more houses for the next 5 years until the scheme ends or supposedly ends, these companies are still going to be very, very profitable. They might not grow much, but they'll be very profitable and they'll be very cash generative. And from an investor's perspective, they will be throwing off large amounts of cash to pay substantial dividends. And this was the point that I made at the presentation at Mello back in April, is that maybe from a perspective of capital gain, they have peaked, and in profitability they are close to peaking as well. But in terms of their ability to throw off cash and pay dividends, they can still actually pay very chunky income or capital returns to shareholders. The problem they've got is that the whole industry is now pretty much hooked on Help to Buy. I think Help to Buy is, roughly speaking, 40% of all new build sales. And the danger, I think, for this policy going forward is not in terms of what it means for the house builders, but what it means for the people who are actually buying these houses. Because one of the big advantages of Help to Buy for the builder's point of view is that if a mortgage lender is not lending 95%, but he's lending 75% or 55% because of Help to Buy, the lender's not really worried too much about the selling price of the house. And that means that the builders, arguably, I'm sure they would dispute this, but the builders can actually then use that comfort to push up their prices. And this is one of my sort of thoughts as to why the new build premium has increased and the profits have increased. The problem is for the buyer of the new build home, particularly the recent buyer of the new build home, is that when they come to sell this house, because it's no longer a new build, the buyer of their house doesn't have a Help to Buy mortgage. And if that buyer is coming with a 95% mortgage to buy that house, then the building society or the bank that's lending that money cares a lot about the value of that house, because they've only got 5% buffer before they start losing money.
Absolutely. And they're comparing that house to the other house that's down the road that's now 3 or 4 years old, and saying that price is, it doesn't sit well with me, and maybe it's overvalued, let's have it reinstated.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. There's actually a new build development about a quarter of a mile from where I'm sitting now. And this is in Essex. And there's a 4-bedroom detached house on that development, and the developers priced it up for £537,000. You go look at similar properties within the local area, and four bedroom semi, which is 537,000, which is a lot of money. In the existing market, those houses are selling for about £450,000. So you can get the price because through Help to Buy, you can get that premium. But as soon as somebody buys that house and pays that price, effectively, they own a house that's worth $450,000 on the second-hand market. It's a bit like driving a new car out of a car dealership. You know, you pay top dollar for it, and you've lost a load of money as soon as you drive it out. And this is going to become a big problem, in my opinion. I'm already reading reports in newspapers and property forums that, you know, there is a growing concern that certainly people who have bought through Help to Buy recently, there could be an issue of negative equity, and that these people will actually struggle to sell their houses. Now, if that view becomes entrenched and becomes more widespread, then people will naturally think very carefully before they start buying a new build house, or they will demand that new build prices come down. Now that is something for the builders to worry about.
Absolutely. It'd be a huge domino effect. I wanted to touch some of the reading that I've done recently, Phil, in a sense of some of the house prices and the salaries and so on and so forth. Now, there's a really, really good article that I've read, and it was touching on how the number of houses that have been built by various house builders, and I'll name a few, the rise in their operating profit and the pay that the execs have taken. And to touch on your point, one article was saying, on average, with new builds, that the CFO or the CEO were taking a big chunk of these quite pricey houses, of on average about £50,000 was going straight into their back pocket, you know, in the sense of their future bonuses and salaries. So houses and homes built, an increase, right? Barratt Development, 35% increase since 2013, right? Bellway, 85% increase in homes built. So those are all new builds. Bovis, 55% increase since 2013. Redrow, 120% increase. Now, with regards to rising profits and going back to Bellway, there's a 399% increase there in their operating profits. And in Redrow, a 571% increase. So that tells you that all those new builds were the main source of their generation of income. But obviously, the main story that's come out of all of this and the debacles is the recent sacking of Persimmon, which, as a disclosure, I've owned shares in that company. And I did buy it because of the dividend when the Brexit vote happened and the share price nearly halved. That's when I purchased them. But as you know, the chief exec, Jeff Fairbairn, has essentially decided to leave, or, you know, the discussion as to whether or not he's resigned this week, because mainly because of the salary and the hefty pay. I think it exceeded over 100 million, you know, of late. So people are getting a tad cheesed off with what's going on in terms of profit making and not looking after the consumers, because the whole point was it was to help the consumers. That's the original point of it all, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't think you'll find many people who will have a big problem with entrepreneurs and risk takers making a lot of money. People who risk their own money to develop a product or a service, and if it pays off, if they make a lot of money, I don't think there's any problem with that. I think the problem you come with the building companies and the bonus to Persimmon, in the Persimmon chief executive, or the outgoing Persimmon chief executive in particular, is that I struggle to see anywhere where he's actually risked a load of his own money. Apart from maybe buying a few shares. And the amount of money that he has ultimately been paid through a bonus scheme that admittedly was set in 2012, before Help to Buy came in, really has nothing to do whatsoever with probably anything that he's done. And I'm sure he would dispute that, and that might be a bit simplistic and maybe a little bit unkind, but when you get a big rise in house prices, the leverage on that in terms of profits is absolutely huge, particularly when you've been selling those houses on land that was bought very cheaply on the back after the recession. And it is the price rise which is pretty much part of government policy that has led to the it largely explains the increase in property. Of course, you know, you get control of building costs and building the right homes and that kind of thing. But generally speaking, to be awarded a £110 million bonus and then having it chopping it down to 75 because you think that you have to give something back is still hugely, hugely disproportional to the effort that's gone into to make that kind of money.
Agreed, Phil. Now, I wanted to touch on a little bit with the what happened with the budget and the big thing. I know we're talking a bit more about the Help to Buy situation, but the big news that came out of it all, and maybe it was a little tentative sort of move by the government, was the change the rules to Help to Buy and capped it regionally. So in the Northeast, if you pay more than, I think it's 186, Northwest, you know, Southeast, 437. So they're trying to move it slightly to help people in different areas. What are your thoughts on that? And does that help, or does that impinge on actually the first time buyers that they're meant to help in the first place? Or are they trying to signal to the house builders and the CEOs, actually, this, you know, this money pot that you've had for a little while, this golden egg, we're going to be getting rid of it soon?
I mean, I'd like to see the scheme scrapped because there are plenty of 95% mortgages available. There's no shortage of banks that are willing. All the big banks will lend 95% of the value, the price of a house out there. You know, you go to any big high street bank and they'll do that. So I struggle to see why the scheme exists. Having said that, I think some of the changes are good in terms of just focusing on first-time buyers. I think in terms of the impact on the house bill, I think it's pretty small. If you look at the average selling prices and the type of houses that these companies are building and what they're trying to sell them for, I can't really see how this new tweaked and extended Help to Buy scheme damages them too much. I think the issue for Help to Buy, if anything, is not really anything to do with the budget. It's due to the fact that it's the Help to Buy scheme is capped at £600,000 selling price, and if you're a builder in the South and the affluent parts of the Southeast, and you want to build family houses, it's going to be hard for you to shift a lot more above 600,000. And you've seen that actually starting to appear in the figures of companies like Crest Nicholson, for example.
Yes.
For those builders that are selling, you know, in other areas, the Midlands, the North, I don't think it's going to be a big problem at all. And if you look at like a northern builder like MJ Gleeson, where the average selling price is in the low to mid hundreds of thousands, they're not going to be unhappy about this at all. I still think this is a political story that potentially can still hold some threat to house builders, particularly if sellers get trapped in houses that they struggle to sell without losing money. That's not related to the budget. So I don't think the budget addresses this policy in terms of what it needs to do.
Okay, so in your view, I mean, obviously you touched on it earlier in the sense of the Help to Buy has pushed prices up of all new builds. Yeah, we agreed on that. But you're not really sure whether or not the cap will actually push it back down again, or slow it down.
I don't think it will.
Okay.
I think the selling price now will become more sort of market determined. I think the builders have got as close as they can to widening the premium between the new build and the existing properties in the same area. And there's the press are now catching on to this as well. There's a journalist in the Times who's really got the bit between his teeth on this, and is writing some quite good articles about it. So public awareness of the value for money of new build pricing, I think, is going to come under closer scrutiny. And I think builders are going to have to adapt to that. And what it means for their profits remains to be seen. But I can't see profits and profit margins going much higher than where they are now.
Okay. All right, then. I think we've covered that regarding the builders the scenarios regarding Help to Buy and the movements. I think the last point on that is the Redrow CEO has also decided to move on after it came back in, I think, 2009, and he's now going to leave 10 years after he came back. And they've done extremely well as well from the whole situation. I wanted to ask you, Phil, if I could move on to another subject here, in a sense of we've just had the midterms, we've had a sticky August and a sticky October. What are your thoughts about the markets going on to the Q4 and to year end? Everyone tends to be thinking, oh, you know, markets have been difficult, but we'll be fine, in a sense of we're going to get the normal last 3 weeks or last week or so rally into the year end. What are your thoughts of the markets going forward from here?
I've got no idea. I mean, I tend not to really think about markets, and I would encourage people to do the same and just to focus on individual companies. Having said that, there are market factors and economic factors that investors need to keep a close eye on, and particularly the interest rate, which we touched on right at the beginning of this conversation. And you mentioned the sort of midterms and what's been going on in America. But I'm not a massive fan of politics. I don't particularly hold politicians in particularly high regard. And I don't think much is going to change for the next couple of years for what it's worth. What I do think is important for investors to keep an eye on is particularly the health of the American economy and also the finances of the American government. And to a lesser extent, not much less, also the same argument is true, or the same point is true, for the finances of the British government. And if you look at the American government, we know that interest rates on bonds, the cost that the government has to pay to borrow money from investors, has been going up. And Donald Trump has cut a lot of taxes, and he's borrowing a lot of money to do that. And America is running, you know, there or thereabouts, pretty much close to $1 trillion deficit, the difference between the taxes it takes in and the money that it spends. And it has to finance that. And if you get any weakness in the economy, then the amount, the deficit will go up. And Donald Trump seems to be pursuing a policy of having a fight with one of his biggest creditors, the Chinese, who have for years have actually helped fund the American government and fund the American deficit. And it's a very dangerous game. Now, of course, both Britain and the US have one big advantage over, say, the Eurozone economies, in that they can print their own money. And we've seen central banks of both countries print money or create money and buy bonds. And that could happen again if the economy goes soft. The key issue will be is what will happen to the price of those bonds and the interest rates on those bonds. And I don't really know. All I will say is that there is a threat out there which shouldn't be completely ignored, that interest rates could continue to rise. And if interest rates continue to rise, I'm talking about bond interest rates here, not the Bank of England base rates or the Federal Reserve rate, that the actual interest rate on government bonds could continue to rise. And if that happens, for the wrong reasons, which is people get concerned about government finances rather than an economy that is growing strongly, then shares in general and highly priced shares, as we've seen, could be in for a rocky ride. But, you know, my opinion's worth about as much as anybody else's on this.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, that's, we've had a very, very good run.
Agreed,
you know, yeah. We've had 10 years of low interest rates, strong profit growth, and the market, you know, the market prices of businesses, very good businesses, have done very well because of that. And the other thing, you know, the other thing that I've learned is that it's very easy to be a pessimist. And I think one of my biggest weakness and failings as in investing over my entire life is I have probably been too pessimistic. And that's something that I've tried to keep in check the last few years. And because I think a position of cautious, considered optimism is what you need. And there's no, if you look at, you know, look at the sort of state of affairs where we are and take into account all the moving parts that are going on in the world, then definitely hold the view that over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, good companies that make things or provide services that people want, that do things that other companies can't easily copy, probably going to do reasonably well. You know, they're probably still going to be able to keep on growing their profits. And, you know, you weigh that up against, you know, the alternatives of having cash in the bank, owning bonds. And investors, unfortunately, don't have much other places to go. So I think that, you know, the strategy of owning very, very good businesses is still, in my opinion, a good one to have. But I think it's going to be harder to make stellar profits from that kind of strategy. Will you still be able to increase the buying power of your money and buy that, you know, have a return, a growth of your portfolio greater than inflation? I would hope yes. And the other thing I would say is that if you stick to these good companies, you are taking a much lower risk with your portfolio. I'm talking about business risk, not stock market risk. And eventually, you know, the stock market will reflect or does reflect reality. And I think one of the key reasons focusing on these good businesses is because it is a less risky approach, because you are buying something that is incredibly robust and durable.
Absolutely agree. I mean, there's a really good chart that I've seen recently, and it showed exactly what you're saying about buying into quality. And the example that was used was the S&P 500. Now, if you'd bought that in October 2007, which is what, 8 months before or 6 months before we had the almighty crash of 2008, you invested £100,000 then, and you'd left it in value in quality companies and rode it out all the way to yesterday's date, that £100,000 would now be worth £175,000, which isn't bad given that you'd done absolutely nothing and just held tight and kept all your investments in check. But as we touched on in the middle of this interview, in this conversation, was that people are churning and buying and going, whatever's hot today, they want to be on it because some of their friends are invested in it. And whatever's hot in the press or been tipped on a Sunday night or a whatever day of the week, they want to be jumping on it. And my view is sometimes stick with quality. And if the opportunity arises and you see it's still, the quality of the company is still intact, look to reinvest, because you're reinvesting in the stock anyway if you're dripping and compounding your dividends as they come back to you. So research your stock, do more research than other people, and stay vigilant and not to be swayed by the noise.
Yeah, good advice, Peter. I think, you know, I look at this as like it's like the tortoise, you know, the race between the tortoise and the hare.
Agreed.
And like over the long run, however long you want to make the long run, the tortoise usually does pretty well. And it comes back to something I said a few minutes as well. It's you need to think a lot about the risks that you're taking. And, you know, the returns that you're trying to generate from your portfolio versus the risk that you're taking. Now, if you're going to buy small cap companies, illiquid small cap companies, and you make a lot of money, then that's good. But don't try and, you know, kid yourself that you haven't taken a lot of risk with your money in the meantime. And I think, you know, the sort of quality investing approach is about delivering risk adjusted returns that are good and consistent, and doing it in a way that helps you sleep easily at night so that you stay the course. And I think that's very important. If you believe that you're buying into a sound business that can keep chugging away over the years, you're much less likely to panic about it when the stock market goes into one of its bad moods. Whereas if you are buying a momentum share where the share price has perhaps got away from the underlying fundamentals of the business, you're more likely to get shaken out. And we see that time and time again.
Absolutely. I think I'd like to just close, Phil, on one of the points that you touched on, and you may want to expand on it whilst we've got a little bit of time here, is with regards to valuation, which you've touched on several times in our conversation, is about quality being more important, or is it more important than price? And I think we both agree, and we've had these conversations before, that it's always better to buy quality in a sense of, you know, watching the price. Quality will always, you know, outlast. The price will fluctuate, but quality will outlast.
I agree, but you have to have something else as well. You have to have growth.
Yes, absolutely.
Quality without growth is not going to work, and that's the key to this kind of investing approach. You have to invest in companies are still capable of growing their profits and their cash flows going forward, and you have to pay a fair price for them, but not too much.
Agreed. Now, Phil, I've covered all my questions. It's been really, really great speaking with you again. Is there any final points or something you want to be saying to people listening to this interview that they need to be looking out for, or be, you know, vigilant of going forward?
Not really. I just have your strategy, whatever it is, stick to it, keep reading, keep monitoring your investments, and believe in what you're doing, and don't let the stock market shake you out of it.
Excellent. Thank you ever so much. That was Phil Oakley of Investors Chronicle, and the author of the book How to Pick Quality Shares, which will make a good stocking filler for those that have got investors in their family and also want to be better investors in quality shares. Phil, thank you ever so much. Thank you for being on Conquest Corner again with me and sharing your well-regarded and highly respected views on investing. Thank you again, Phil.
My pleasure, Peter, and thanks for asking me back.
All right. Thank you, mate. And hopefully we'll catch up soon at another event.
Hopefully.
All right. Take care, fella. Bye for now.
Thank you.